Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Joshua Leonard, Heather Donahue, and Michael Williams, the actors from the original Blair Witch Project, saw that Lionsgate plans to reboot the franchise again. This is the second reboot. And decided that now is the time to ask for money. Like more money. To recap, the Blair Witch Project was shot on a shoestring in pure indie style, which is to say not under the rules of various union agreements that would have guaranteed various minimums and residuals and all that sort of thing. When Artisan bought the worldwide rights to the film, which each of the actors was paid about $300,000 for their share of the ownership, which undoubtedly seemed like a great deal at the time because they shot it for, you know, around $60,000. Estimates vary, but let's say $60,000 plus post-production work, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, it was a pretty good deal. That's a pretty good deal, $300,000. I mean, when I was 20-something, I did not have $300,000. And it probably felt like a much less good deal, however, when the film became a worldwide smash, grossing nearly $250 million worldwide. Those ownership points would have been worth a little bit more, probably. In the ensuing years, there was a sequel for which the actors did not get paid despite having their appearances in the film. Lionsgate bought Artisan, bought the actual studio, you know. They made a reboot, Lionsgate did, which the actors were not consulted on. And the studio apparently operates an escape room in Las Vegas based on the Blair Witch Project. Good to know. I'm going to check that out the next time I'm in Vegas. But again, the film was not shot under union productions. There are no residuals. There's no, you know, need to discuss with them, you know, whether or not this is good or bad or whatever. So the trio are asking for retroactive and future residual payments for the film. Quote, they want, quote, meaningful consultation, end quote, on all future Blair Witch projects, including, again, any escape rooms. I'm fascinated by this escape room thing. And just to prove that they're not in this for their own sakes, that they're doing this for the people, they want Lionsgate to provide a $60,000 grant annually to random people who want to make a movie. This is kind of an interesting situation in the sense that I feel like Lionsgate probably could have benefited, you know, from a marketing standpoint, at the very least, by releasing a new Blair Witch with marketing, tagging it as from the original team or endorsed by the original team, right? Like, you hated the sequel, you ignored the reboot, so we got the gang back together. Something to that effect, regardless of how much actual input they had. And, you know, judging by their post-Blair Witch output, I'm guessing the amount of input would have been, well, let's just say not a ton of it. But anyway, this is all kind of beside the point. This is all kind of beside the point, because I feel like the studio basically has to say no to the demands of payments from the actors who aren't owed for services previously rendered, because otherwise you open up the floodgates. Like, all this chatter about residuals here is kind of a smokescreen, because they were paid and paid very well. This is not, you don't see a lot of payouts like that. One imagines that the precedent here would be fairly expensive, with all sorts of indie stars crawling out of the woodwork to demand money for services already rendered and compensated for. But maybe I shouldn't dismiss this. I mean, look, I've done freelance work. You guys have done freelance work. I would like to get paid more for the same work while not really having to do any more for it. Peter, who do you think should be giving you more money for the work you've already been paid for?
Oh, all of my employers in the, you know, in the aughts. When I was in my 20s, I have become a very successful IP and a big franchise, and they need to pay me retroactively for all of that, because Sonny, I don't know if you know about this. This might be like a little bit of a shock to you, but if you were writing online movie reviews in like 2006, you probably weren't making a lot of money at it. Maybe you were making no money at all, and maybe you were making, sometimes I make money, and sometimes I make zero money, and sometimes I make so much money that I can afford to drink a beer this Friday, but that's basically it. And I absolutely deserve, no, this is ridiculous. Come on, this whole thing is absurd. I get it. I actually, like, I will say that I am rarely, like, in a story like this, I'm typically like hard-hearted and just like, who cares? Like, these, they got actually paid quite well. When you get paid $300,000 for a movie that was made for $60,000 that you like had to expect just based on the type of thing that it was. Like you had to expect that that thing was not going to make any money or not going to make any serious money. And then it was a fluke. It was a total fluke. Like, yes, I mean, or at least it was totally unheard of. Maybe it wasn't quite a fluke because found footage and sort of low budget stuff has like proven over the past 25 years to be actually a bigger potential moneymaker. But like no one knew at that time. And they took $300,000 each to not have any control or credit. And that seems to me like that is the deal that they made. And mm-hmm. when you make that deal, it feels like a big upside. But the whole thing is you're giving away the right to ask for anything else later. At the same time, like this thing has probably, I mean, I don't know what the total grosses for Blair Witch branded stuff over the years are. But the first one was $250 million. You got to assume that probably if you combine the franchises, especially if there's another one coming out, you got to assume that this is at bare minimum a $500 million franchise and probably verging on $1 billion. And these folks took $300,000 each. I don't think it's totally insane for them to ask for more money. I kind of don't think the studio should give it to them. They definitely shouldn't give them any more creative control. The $60,000 thing is absolutely a sort of bid to make it look like they are, you know, not just in this for personal gain. It's mm-hmm. pretty telling. But like, I'm sympathetic. Like, it sucks. Like, that they made a bad deal. Like, but yeah. They also made that deal knowing very clearly going in that almost anyone, like, in the history of people who have made deals like that, has come out ahead by taking the $300,000. It's just that they are the one in 10,000, one in 100,000, one in 1 million of all. Like, I don't know how many people have ever gotten a deal like that, but almost all of the others. Possibly literally all of the other people who got a deal that is something equivalent to that, like, came out way ahead in the scheme of things, and they just didn't. And this is the business in some ways. I would say that, like, the closest analog here that we should talk about is the comic book industry, where there have been big fights over massive properties that were created under work-for-hire type arrangements or even back in the early days of comic books, where it was just expected that creators would hand over copyrights to creations basically for free, which is more or less what happened with the original Superman. And then later, often decades later, when Superman became Superman, right? Which Superman wasn't in the 1930s, but by the 1970s was obviously a huge property. At that point, like, that stuff did get renegotiated. DC Comics made a bunch of concessions to Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster in order to keep the copyright, paid them actually quite a bit of money, gave them health insurance, that sort of thing. So I don't know. I mean, my heart goes out to them because they did, in fact, make a bad deal. On the other hand, they made that deal. And when you put your name, when you sign that contract, what you're saying is, I'm not going back on this. That is like, and yeah, that's how the legal system works. That's how business works. There's not a world in which you can have contracts like that. And then studios just like, oh, wait, no, actually. Like, the reason that they would do that is if they wanted to keep working with those people at a high price. And right. those people, the folks here, again, you know, God bless them. It sucks. But it's not like they've had hugely successful creative careers.
Yeah. I mean, Alyssa, the interesting angle here, I think, is the kind of invoking the union as if to say, you know, we didn't have the union protections we should have had. But like, you're making an indie film. If you had made that film with the union, it would have been a million times more expensive. It never would have been made. That movie simply doesn't exist if you try to make it under the aegis of SAG or whatever, which, you know, is a, you know, that's a whole different question. Peter invokes the comic book precedent here, but like, again, this is a different situation because they made the thing and then they sold the thing and they got a lot of money. It's not like they were doing work for hire or they happened to be, you know, slugs in the machine at Lionsgate or whatever. Like, they were compensated. I just have a hard time seeing their point here.
Yeah. And I, you know, as the person on the podcast who's supposed to be the sort of bleeding heart and the squish, I actually sort of share both of your positions. You know, when I was a young journalist, I actually did a lot of work for free. I was coming up in journalism at a time when the blogging ecosystem often worked in a way that where there are a lot of sort of reciprocal trades. And so, you know, I guest blogged for Andrew Sullivan. I launched my own blog on the back of a guest blogging gig from Matt Iglesias at The Atlantic. And I did all of that work for free. I did this so long ago that that guest blogging stint for Iglesias, my co-guest blogger was Ta-Nehisi Coates. And so, you know, I did that work for free. It was uncompensated. At the same time, you know, a couple years later, Matt helped me get my first time writing job. And so I made what was, you know, on the face of it, like a bad deal. I did a bunch of work for no money. But I was sort of gambling as a creative, you know, in a loose sense that I would be able to use that to build my own career. And it's worked out, right? I mean, I'm a columnist and letters editor at the Washington Post. I, you know, sort of made that bet sort of on myself. And sometimes you make bad deals. I think it can be a good look for corporations or artists to be retroactively generous if something is a huge hit. Like Taylor Swift has gotten herself a bunch of very good headlines for giving exceptionally generous bonuses to, you know, the truckers who worked on the Eras tour, and, you know, sort of other people who are, you know, behind the stage, below the scenes, you know, and these are really quite substantial amounts of money that she's giving out for people who, you know, again, had no contracted right to it and no even artistic role in her massive success. And I think that's a good thing to do. It's good to be generous where possible. But I think it is just very hard to come back 20, however many years later and say, like, it didn't work. I'd like to be made whole when, you know, when you don't have something to offer. And you know, the time for someone to be corporately generous probably was 20 years ago. But at this point, you know, when the franchise has been acquired, the studio has been sold, and there's not someone to keep happy, you know, don't ask, don't get, right? You know, maybe you shoot your shot and you get some money, but I don't think they should expect much. And I don't think they, you know, I don't think any corporate entity is under obligation to give them money.
So I have a question actually, though, for both of you. Do you, either of you understand what happened with the thing that Sonny referenced with the immediate sequel? So there was a sequel that came, I don't know, 3 years, 2 years later, and it apparently used their names and likenesses, right? And in part, they used their names because the way that the first Blair Witch was structured was the actors were more or less improv-ing everything. It was shot really quickly, and they were using their own real first names, right? So it would be like if we shot a movie with the three of us, and it was Peter, Alyssa, and Sonny, right? And those were the character names. And in the second one, they used, apparently, somehow or another, used the likenesses and the names of these people, and they didn't get paid for it at all. And that seems a little bit, that one, like, that actually, like, bugs me a little more than the rest of this here. Well, and I almost feel like if their case had just been, well, you guys used our likenesses without compensation.
Well, they sued for that at the time. And I don't know exactly how that shook out.
But that seems like the more clear violation of a kind of right to your person as an actor, right? Where it's not, this isn't even like a synthetic thing, like AI is sort of generating something else based on you. This is, they're just using your name, and I guess it was like at least a photo, right?
But I'm sure they signed away franchise rights, et cetera, et cetera. I mean,
if they signed away the rights, then that's one thing, because in fact, actors do that. Like, that's part of the way that these things get dealt with. But if it was used without permission, like genuinely without permission and without a contractual right, then that seems to me like a clearer case for the actors here.
I'll take the side of the actors on this they should be compensated in the future going forward, just not in the way that they are pitching here. I mean, I'm really curious. Maybe we'll find out one day. I would like to know if there were discussions with Lionsgate where they went to Lionsgate and they said, hey, we would like involvement. You know, we'd like to help with the story, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because I really do think that Lionsgate is making a mistake here by not involving them in some way, not getting their, you know, input, even if, again, God only knows, you know, what sort of money we're talking about, what sort of figures are being thrown around. But I feel like being able to say, being able to pitch this as sort of a requel, right, or you know, a reappearance of the original gang, and I feel like that's got to be worth at least, you know, $1 million. I feel like that's free advertising. You get a bunch of stories about that. You generate some goodwill. They're out there talking about it. You know, I feel like that is just smart PR studio stuff.
Maybe. Yeah. Or maybe these folks are difficult to work with, or maybe they're not difficult to work with, but the Lionsgate executives have bad blood there after years of the, right? Like, this seems like there's probably not great relations between, certainly the actors here who are making this request and the folks who own the property at this point. Because otherwise this would not be done via open letter. This would be negotiated quietly if those folks had good working relations already. And we all know that in a creative industry, sometimes you don't want to work with people for a variety of reasons. And those reasons can be that those people are difficult, or we think those people's ideas aren't very good, or those people are whatever, or just like sometimes it's like the executives are the difficult ones and the creatives are like have good ideas, but the executives are terrible, right? I have no idea what it is in this situation or if there's any bad blood at all, but it does seem, based on the visible evidence from the outside sitting in my office at home in Washington, D.C. and not knowing the players personally, it does seem like I would guess that they're not like on great working terms here.
All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or a controversy that the Blair Witch Project actors want more money? Peter.
It's never a controversy when someone wants more money. Everybody wants more money.
That's why they call it money. Alyssa.
I mean, it's not controversial, and it'll be non-controversial when they get turned down.
Well, I think the way they went about it is mildly controversial. Frankly, I just want to do the Blair Witch Project escape room with them. I want to be stuck in a room with them. And try to get out of it while the Blair Witch is putting people in the corner.
I would pay large amounts of money never to have to go into this escape room or any other escape room ever.
Wow.
See, the thing to do in Vegas is to spend all of your time at 24-hour tiki bars that are so dark and so filled with smoke that you can't see the drink in front of you until like it's right touching your nose. And I want to combine that experience with an escape room. I like a smoke-filled 24-hour tiki bar escape room that's Blair Witch themed. And like all of the drinks are like the put you in the corner murder. Like, is like what the title of it is?
It sounds like literal hell.
Absolutely not. Under no circumstances.
All right. Make sure to swing by
Bulwark
Plus.
You guys don't know how to go to Vegas.
Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode, which is going to be like my own personal escape room because Peter is going to make fun of me because one of my favorite directors made a bad movie. Oh, that's never happened before. Oh, God. Anyway, it's going to be the Feel Bad episode of the year coming up on Friday. Very exciting. Now to the main event. Civil War, written and directed by Alex Garland. Civil War picks up in the closing days of the Second American Civil War. The so-called Western forces of Texas and California are marching to Washington, D.C. to depose the president who has liquidated the FBI and illegally ran for a third term in office. We follow a quartet of journalists. There's photographer Lee Smith, played by Kirsten Dunst, writer Joel, played by Wagner Moura, veteran New York Times correspondent Sammy, played by Stephen McKinley Henderson, and the neophyte photographer Jesse, who's played by Kaylee Spaney. As they drive to New York City, they loop around through Pittsburgh to avoid destroyed roads and battle zones, then over around through West Virginia, down to Charlottesville, and then up to D.C. Big circuitous route. Takes like 900 miles to get from New York to D.C. That's crazy. Joel wants to get a quote from the president. No one has interviewed him since the conflict began because the press are treated like enemy combatants and journalists are shot on sight in the Capitol. Lee is just tired, man. She's just depressed. She's lost faith in journalism. She says that the photos from war zones that she took were intended as warnings, but nobody in America listened to them. And here we are. Civil War is rigorously nonpartisan. And I say nonpartisan very specifically, I mean, the president is not named, no parties are identified, the contours of the conflict are undefined, so it doesn't turn into a culture war football of the sort that we see play out all the time in the movies. But that is not to say that it's non-political. This is not a movie that sets out to tut-tut and say, well, one side in our current struggle is clearly right and one side is clearly wrong, and I'm on your side. I, the filmmaker, am on your side. If you see yourself or your allies in either the president or the roving death squads, and you get mad at the movie rather than yourself or your allies, you're telling on yourself. Just keep it, just be quiet. Don't bring that up to anyone. Civil War is a travelogue, really. It's punctuated by moments of terror or excitement, I guess, depending on your POV. We smash cut from the journalist falling asleep to the soothing sounds of distant gunfire, to bullets smashing into a pillar behind which a member of the Western forces is hiding. Our photographers and our writers trying to capture his terror as the battle rages on. We see folks trying to keep their heads down in a suburban town and act as if everything is normal, just with yards being watered and clothes for sale in a secondhand store. And then the camera tilts up a bit and we see the snipers on the rooftops. We see soldiers carefully explaining that they don't know who they're shooting at or why, but they're returning fire so they don't die. We see gas station attendants who have strung up looters, but whose real crime seems to be that they didn't treat the guy with the gun nicely in high school. And that's kind of the real point of the film, at least on the political front. It is horrifying and irresponsible to wish this kind of sectarian conflict into our lives, to cosplay as Civil War reenactors or creators in the modern times, because this sort of conflict always devolves into ugly score settling. And I am fascinated. I am fascinated by some of the responses to this film from folks demanding that Alex Garland really spoon feed them who the good guys and who the bad guys are here. There are viewers, I feel like, who want permission to feel good about witnessing the shooting of wounded men, right? Or watching the Western forces turn their 50 cal loose on a group of POWs executing the unarmed enemies. I think the denial of that permission makes some viewers kind of uncomfortable, because it means that the movie is at least partly about them. Maybe this is the film that some argued the zone of interest is, right? It's one that actually implicates the audience in what it depicts and thus makes them uncomfortable. I'm also fascinated by the folks who have suggested that this movie is a love letter to journalism, that the journalists are, you know, this is really about the importance of their work and the greatness of what they do. Because the journalists are portrayed as either kind of world-weary and spiritually broken or adrenaline junkie thrill seekers, prone to saying things like gunfire in the distance gives them erections, right? Yes, Lee is the film's conscience in her own way, and yes, Jesse is the audience surrogate, but we also see journalists doing shots after a suicide bombing, right? We see that Joel only brings Jesse along on this trip because he wants to sleep with her. And a horribly immature bit of horseplay on the road between two groups of journalists leads to a tragedy, this most striking scene in the film. Maybe we'll talk about it in a minute. This is a far more dyspeptic film about journalism than some have left on. There are definite echoes of the movie Nightcrawler in here, which was a very, I would say, dark look at the role of tabloid journalists and news gatherers in the TV scene. Alyssa, I don't know if Civil War is the best movie I've seen all year, but it is the best one I've seen so far. I do get the sense, however, that you did not love it quite as much as I did.
It's interesting. I was frustrated with this movie when I initially saw it. And I think that's in part because I really, really, really love Alex Garland's work in general. I mean, Devs was absolutely the most striking thing I saw in 2020. That's the miniseries he did about sort of, you know, huge computer models. It would be really worth revisiting at some point. I really liked Men, which I think I liked much more than both of you. He is just one of the most, you know, visually striking directors working. There's an interesting combination of chilliness and empathy. There's just so much at work in his movies. I hated this movie on a dialogue level. I really, really did not like most of the scenes that were people talking. You know, maybe they were intended to sort of evoke journalistic cliches, but on a, just sort of like on a language level, this movie did not work for me while I was watching it. And yet I am thinking about it all of the time. I really have not stopped thinking about it since I saw it, because I think it is so powerful on an image level. I could go either way on the decision not to provide sort of any information about what the conflict is about or about how the various sides kind of came together in a coalition, right? I think there's an argument, you know, for doing it exactly the way he does it, to sort of force you to just focus on the nature of the conflict, the sort of personal degradation, the cost of witnessing it, and just the sort of the strangeness of seeing America as a war zone, which is something that, you know, nobody alive has had to experience except for, I mean, in, you know, considering Pearl Harbor on September 11th sort of separately, you know, we have not had, you know, ongoing battles in the United States since the Civil War. On the other hand, I think it's a little bit of a dodge, right? You know, it's the, I think the sort of joining together of Texas and California is kind of meant to be deliberately jarring, but it also can sort of leave you wondering, okay, how did we get to a place where, you know, Gavin Newsom and Greg Abbott have, you know, teamed up to overthrow the, you know, the federal government. But, you know, I do think that feels like a dodge some of the time. But oh my God, just the images in this movie, right? I mean, there's a scene where the characters are interviewing a couple of soldiers who are just sniping at someone in a, like, in a house at the center of a sort of cheapo
range or something. Yeah.
Well, it's like a cheapo sort of Christmas display that's left over. And, you know, you see the camouflage on the sniper's gun that looks like some of the moss and biological stuff in Annihilation, right? His adaptation of Jeff Vandermeer's novel about the sort of encroachment of a zone where the laws of biology sort of break down. And the just the combination of the strangeness of the dialogue there and the strangeness of the image is incredible. The, you know, the scene where the characters are following some Western Forces troops through a gun battle, you know, just sort of moving room to room, documenting as they, you know, do sort of field medicine on one of their number who's been shot. And then the confrontation between, you know, the journalists and a soldier played by Jesse Plemons that Sonny mentioned, which is definitely, I think, will almost certainly be the scariest thing I see this year. Not because of necessarily even any particularly macabre imagery, although it does take place at the edge of a mass grave, but, you know, the casual strangeness of the way Plemons plays that character is so horrifying and unnerving. I mean, it's a tremendous little performance. I don't even know that he's credited in the movie. I was just looking at the IMDb credits for it. And so I'm really frustrated with this movie, but it has lodged itself in my brain the way that few things other than Alex Garland movies ever do. And it's kind of exciting to me that something this sort of deliberately off-putting and upsetting has won the box office two weekends in a row, even in a somewhat fallow period. I don't quite know what I feel about this movie, and I think that's kind of a good thing. I am glad to be here listening to you two talk about it, because I can't totally sort out my feelings about it, but I do want to keep talking about it.
Peter, I want to drill down on this, on discussing the kind of partisan politics, the political angle of it, because I think one of the reasons why it is lodged in Alyssa's head and my own is because you don't get bogged down into working through the counterfactual details of, well, if this happened, there's no way that I, like, again, the way you put it, Alyssa, there's no way Greg Abbott and Gavin Newsom would team up. Well, yeah, right now, no, but maybe in a different circumstance, or if they weren't the governors, or who, God only knows what would happen in the intervening years. You know, who knows who has been assassinated, who has been, you know, who is still around. Because the real point of this movie, again, is to get beyond that and just to be like, guys, everybody chill the hell out for a minute, because this sort of thing gets real ugly real fast and you can't understand what's happening even as it's happening.
I think it's important to note that Alex Garland wrote the screenplay for this movie in the summer of 2020. as the world had been turned upside down by a pandemic, as American cities were wrecked by protests that grew unruly and sometimes violent. I mean, just, you know, not even a mile from my house, there were cars burning and, you know, looting happening in June of 2020. It was very intense. You know, nights where there were nights in a row, multiple nights in a row where the city was under a curfew and you could just watch on Twitter or, you know, other social media, you could see videos of people just breaking into to establishments all over town. And then for even after the violence, you know, mostly calmed down, there was still boarding up of the city. And then when the, you know, inauguration happened in January of 2021, there was effectively a sort of military lockdown zone in the, you know, at the heart of the city, when typically you see this sort of big public display of people just kind of walking around right during the inaugural period. And instead it became like something out of an Alex Garland movie, actually. And so this movie was written in that period where suddenly the kind of expectations of normal civilization and normal society had in fact totally broken down, not to the extent that they do in this movie, but in a way that is pretty unprecedented in our lifetimes. Certainly we haven't seen anything exactly precisely like that, although we have seen other major disruptions. And this movie, it channels that in so many ways, but it also channels Alex Garland's personal obsessions. And I think you have to read this movie as this is the evolution of Alex Garland. Go back to the movie that launched his career as a screenwriter and then eventually a director, 28 Days Later, right? So it's directed by Danny Boyle, but it's so clearly an Alex Garland film in so many ways. And I don't mean to undercut Boyle's contribution there, but you just see it all, it's structured just like Civil War. What is the opening of that movie? The opening is a bunch of crazy, I think we're supposed to kind of sense that they are left wing, but they're animal rights protesters who break into a lab and let a bunch of monkeys escape. And it turns out that the monkeys are infected with a virus. And what is the virus? The virus is rage. And then we just cut to, oh shit, that virus is everywhere. The virus is rage. And we wake and we go to a hospital where a character has woken up in a world that has been transformed while he's been in a coma for 28 days. And that world is a world that has been wrecked and destroyed by rage. And then it's a road trip movie, basically, into the heart of human rage darkness, right? Into the heart of rage world. This is that. This is a road trip movie into the heart of rage world with politics instead of the virus as the kind of backdrop for it. But this is Alex Garland's obsession, is a world with it. What happens when you enter into a world in which the rules have been suspended, that the things about civilization that we take for granted, about normal, the normal operations of our lives. That's true in Annihilation, although it's about this sort of biological world, right? It's just a zone, right? Annihilation is about going into a zone where biology doesn't work like it normally does anymore. It's true in, you know, in The Beach, even, where you sort of enter, the novel that made him sort of a big deal as a writer in the 1990s, and then was adapted by Danny Boyle. Garland did not write the screenplay, but it's true of The Beach, which is about this sort of utopian society that turns out not to be all that utopian. He's just interested in these worlds where the things that keep, where civilization as we know it has been put on hold or broken. It's true even in Devs. Devs is a story about somebody who is so wracked by personal loss that he attempts to build a world where that loss can be undone, right? And it's a truly great series. It's incredibly underrated, in part because it was running basically in March and April of 2020. Folks, I just I will second here. Like, if you have not gone back and watched Devs, which understandable that you missed it because other things were going on in the world at that time. If you have not watched it, oh my gosh, it might be my favorite sort of tail end peak TV miniseries period. Certainly it's the most underrated thing in the last 5 years. But this to me is is what this story is about. And I love it for all of the same reasons that I love those other Alex Garland works. And even as somebody who shares Alyssa's slight frustration with some of the dialogue, which I think is clunky and direct, especially in the first 30 minutes of this movie, where before it really gets going, where you sort of have your quartet of journalists doing a kind of Hollywood journalism talk that I think is not particularly realistic. But what those sequences are there to do is to just force you to stop treating this movie like the op-ed style political tract that in some ways it was frankly advertised as, that you sort of, that this title at the, kind of suggests that it might be, especially sort of coming out in 2024 in an election year, right? That all of the bits there, it's direct, it's pushy. But Garland is just saying, we have to get past that because that's not what I'm interested in. I don't care about California and Texas and Florida and are they fighting over like Medicaid funding or something like that? No, that's not it. He's just demand, like every one of those scenes is about demanding that you see this as a story about a modern American or at least a sort of modern Western democratic apocalypse in which society as we know it stops working. But in fact, all of that rage that exists, that is the virus that we all already have, that like you can see, that you could see on the streets of American cities in 2020, that you can see on Twitter every day. Like what happens when that is unleashed, when the stuff that's holding that back goes away, and this movie gives it to us, and it's horrible. Also, the final 30 minutes in DC are freaking incredible. I cannot believe that he shot action sequences that look that good, that are that pulse pounding and scary, that like have this like incredible balance of being like making me freak, like actually uncomfortable because it looks so much like they actually shot it on 17th Street, even though it's just in a warehouse in Atlanta. Like just really great effects work at a pretty modest budget, about $50 million. But this is Alex Garland's big ideas, the movie, like just in a different form. And I love it for that. And I love that he makes people, that he is just absolutely telling all the people who want this to be an op-ed that you can argue about in op-ed terms, like, no, I'm not going to make that movie. And if you want me to make that movie, like, think about why you're mad. Like,
yeah. Can I ask what you guys thought about the treatment of war photography? Because I think it's both, it's a movie that's very interested in the sort of beauty and the horror of these images. But at the same time, it is detached in a way. I guess I understand it as a tribute to war photographers and to sort of photography in general. But I almost wish there had been a little bit more of a clash about what photography is for and how it functions. And I say this in part because a couple of years ago, I worked with Nick Utt, who you guys all probably know the picture from the Vietnam War of a girl running down the road naked, burned by napalm, right? So Nick Utt took that photograph. His older brother was a war photographer who was killed in Vietnam. His brother's mentor, Horst Fass, sort of encouraged him not to, you know, told him at one point, he's like, I hope you take a picture that stops a war. But part of what's really interesting about that photo is the backstory, because, you know, Nick was someone who, you know, he was a very dedicated and accomplished photojournalist, but he wasn't sort of detached in a way that the characters in this movie talk about war photography. He took the picture. He got Kim medical treatment. He actually took her in an AP van to a hospital and threatened the doctors and nurses. And like, I will photograph you turning her away if you don't take her in for treatment. He visited her like when she was hurt. They've been friends for 50 years at this point. But, you know, he was not someone who was necessarily sort of apolitical about the war or uninvolved in the image that he was capturing, right? He provided direct medical treatment to her after she was burned. And there's a sort of, I don't know that it necessarily goes along with the studied lack of information about the sort of sources of the conflict or the ideology. But there's a sort of, there's not an argument among the characters about how journalism is supposed to work. And in fact, like, I found myself really irritated in the final scene. Spoiler alert, if you have not seen Civil War, it's been out for a couple weeks, so I hope you've seen it at this point. It really bothered the hell out of me. And then in the final scene, like, Joel is with the soldiers who are clearly going to execute the corrupt president. And the question he asks is, I need a quote? Like, I'm freaking sorry. But no, like, that drove me insane, right?
But it's a laugh line. I mean, it's a laugh line. It is because this movie does an interesting thing, I think, which is that it draws a distinction between print journalists or writing journalists and photojournalists, right? So there is the so Joel throughout the film is this kind of thrill seeker, adrenaline junkie, like is much less objective in how he wants to cover it, how he talks about it. You see him joking around with the Western Forces guys as they're executing some soldiers. You see him that scene, that shot at the end where he's like, I need a quote. And I think the Nick Offerman president says something like, please don't let them kill me. And he says, that'll do. And it's a button. It's intended to provoke, I think, a laugh. And compare that to how we see Kirsten Dunst's character, Lee Smith, or how we see Jesse throughout the movie, how she kind of evolves into that, just take the photos and let everybody see it. And you also see it in the actual work that we see, right? Like the photos that we see them take, which are both, we see them both, you know, kind of developed, but also just interspersed into the film as like still frames in the film, show a more objective reality than the whatever narrative it is that Joel is crafting, right? Like you can kind of imagine the piece that Joel is putting together that he is going to write. And it just contrasts with the, here it is. Here's the image. Here's the thing. I think it's a really kind of interesting choice myself.
But at the same time, it's just, it is sort of dishonest about the supposed objectivity of photojournalism too, right? I mean, you know, I don't know. The idea that
what's the Brie Larson character in Kong Skull Island? Do you remember this movie? Do you remember Kong Skull Island? So I've
watched it like 15 times while taking a nap.
There's a moment in Kong Skull Island, one of Peter Suderman's favorite films, where Brie Larson literally, I guess maybe almost literally, looks at the camera when somebody says, you're a war photographer? And she says, no, I'm an anti-war photographer. And like, I'm sorry. I'll take the objective, war-weary, world-broken Kirsten Dunst character every day of the week over someone who's like, I'm out here taking pictures to stop war. Because she says earlier in the film, you say there's no argument about journalistic ethics here, but I don't think that's actually right.
I don't think it's journalistic ethics. That's not really what I'm talking about. It's like, you know, styles of journalism, how it works, what it's for, what's the best way to get the picture, what's the, you know, How do you ingratiate yourselves with the people that you want to cover? What's the line about what you'll do while you're embedded, right? I mean, in a way, like part of what's so interesting about the final 30 minutes of the movie is the extent to which you can see the soldiers who Jesse Lee and Joel are embedded with, like making, you know, tactical in the minute decisions around them and around their presence and like about, you know, keeping them relatively safe as they navigate them through the streets of Washington and then the White House. And there's none of, you know, there's none of that acknowledgement of complexity, right? I mean, again, to go back to, you know, that this piece I worked on with Nick Utt, like, you know, the Brie Larson line, like, I'm an anti-war photographer, is like kind of dumb. But at the same time, like Horst Vass, who's one of the greatest, you know, war photographers in Vietnam, is out there telling young Vietnamese photojournalists, like, I hope you take a picture that can stop a war, right? There exists the possibility of like a sort of, you know, ideological commitment to recording this stuff and the world weariness that Lee demonstrates. There are, you know.
Yes, but I don't think that's her. That's just not her character. She is not. She is not the. She. I mean, no, she. She literally. Fine. She says. She says in the movie, I took these pictures in the hopes that to show people not to do this, and they just ignored me anyway. And that's kind of what breaks her spirit. And I like. I think that's actually. I think that's a fairly interesting character choice, and also a fairly interesting comment on the state of journalism, in the sense that, like, I don't know how many journalists you know, Alyssa. I know one or two. And a lot of them are very distressed about the fact that nobody pays attention to their stuff and we're just kind of careening toward, you know, possibly Donald Trump number two here.
But again, this is also another question that the movie doesn't really engage with. It's like, you see people creating a lot of journalism, you see nobody consuming it, right? And there's like... There's a sort of studied, like, you know.
I don't know. I don't
know
how to.
That's very unfamiliar.
I don't know what that feels like, but certainly.
But there's no, you know, nobody seems to have any particular reaction to the fact that, like, journalists are just showing up, right? There's no, like, massaging of sources. There's no, journalism just sort of exists as this weird, like, exploratory profession. And, you know, I mean, there's a deliberate decision, I think, to have them be from Reuters, from, like, a news agency.
Well, I do think it's interesting the shot at the car wash, right? The shot at the car wash where the guy is talking about the two men he is torturing for being, you know, looters, maybe not. And Lee pulls out her camera and says, I want to take your picture. And he goes and kind of poses
and
next
into
to them.
It.
Like,
yeah,
like he's a big game hunter. And I think that is like, I think a very realistic moment. I think that is the sort of thing that you definitely see happen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I can't necessarily say what I would have done differently in this, you know, in this movie, because I am Alyssa Rosenberg, a, you know, dork and movie critic instead of Alex Garland, cinematic genius. And, you know, I'm sure some of this itchiness is the point. I don't know. There's just, I can't stop thinking about it. And there's something about it that doesn't quite work for me. And that's a productive combination, but it does just stick in my craw a little bit.
So if I want to take a slightly more critical line on this, I do think that the movie's portrayal of journalists and how journalists think about journalism is a little bit soft. It's a little bit thin. There's just not quite enough there, though I wouldn't say that it's all wrong or something like that, but it is a little bit frustratingly thin. At the same time, I think that this movie is participating in a tradition of war movies that goes back 50 years to especially to a lot of films sort of after the Vietnam War, where we see foreign conflicts. And sometimes it's a journalist, you know, who is the character who we're seeing it through, right? Or when we see journalists, like, they're just sort of there in the background, like you have bits of this in, like, Full Metal Jacket, right? And what are the journalists even doing there? Like, it's sort of like they're just sort of part of the milieu, part of the scenery, right? Like, and even if the movie is kind of about them, right, there's just this sort of sense of like, well, they're just these bizarre people who go chasing horror that they can document, right? And it just makes them weird, even if they have strong feelings about it, but sometimes they don't. And it just seems like this movie is in some ways trying to recast some of those older war films onto a conventional, a familiar American, you know, sort of modern, familiar American setting to ask us, well, what if it happened here? What would that be like? In some ways, you know, we'd be arguing about, like, well, these sources are, these journalists are reliable and they have these biases, and journalists would be talking a little bit differently, and there'd be all sorts of stuff that isn't in this movie. At the same time, there would just, I think, be, if there were a civil war here along the lines that this movie sort of hints at a certain point, there would just be a kind of sense, well, they're journalists there, they're covering things. Lord knows if anybody's actually paying attention. Somehow people are getting their news, and I guess it's because somebody is seeing something and saying something about it. But it would be this sort of it would be this this sort of mush of like, you can't really, I don't know how to say it. Like it would be difficult and frustrating in many of the ways that this movie is difficult and frustrating. And I think this movie is trying to capture that sort of weariness that happens, not at the spark when sort of things start to happen, but deep into a conflict. I mean, frankly, we have this, you know, in Ukraine now, where we all kind of know what's going on, but like, how much attention are we really, like, are most of you who are not like working on the foreign desk really paying every hour of every day? It's hard. But there are journalists there. And in fact, there are journalists who have gone there for Substack, Tim Mack, right? Like, is there just covering things, like reader funded through Substack. That is a new thing, but that is like coming up in our world. And it's, How do you process that? I think this movie sort of this movie decides to do it by not like getting bogged down in a whole bunch of intra-journalist ethics or, you know, like what is journalism anyway debates. Instead, it's because it's not about journalism. It's about the rules that hold society together and how fragile they are and how and what happens when they are broken.
But at the same time, there would also be vigorous ongoing arguments about how to do the journalism about the war, right? Yes. I mean, you know, my job for about 6 weeks now has been just to sit with the 4,000 letters that, you know, the Post gets every week. That doesn't even count comments. And like the thing that people argue about most of all is what is the correct way to cover Donald Trump, right? And it's like that is just a real live issue for people. And it's in the details. It's, you know, are you running, you know, photographs of him above the fold? Are you running photographs with him with American flags? Are you changing his Truth Social postings from all caps in a way that doesn't quite convey the, you know, the tenor of his messages? Like, and, you know, these aren't even debates among journalists. These are among people who write to the Washington Post because it's really important to them. And it's important to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who are activated enough to send us a letter because they think they can change something about it. And so, you know, the idea that these conversations would sort of disappear in this wasteland doesn't quite strike me as true. Or even that there would be sort of stronger internal disagreements on this road trip and that would be one of the things that you kind of BS about in these long van rides. I don't know. This is more interesting, really, as sort of a, you know, alternative future history movie than as a movie about journalism or about any of our specific ailments. And it's really, really good, unnerving sort of future history. But I don't know that it's quite a great movie about journalism. And I think reading it as a movie even really about America is kind of a mistake.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Civil War? Peter?
Thumbs up. One of the better movies this year, but I've seen Dune 2 four times, I might add. So I'm not sure I think it's the best.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up. Peter and I saw it in IMAX at a screening, and I was not really sure that that format made sense going into it. But coming out of it, I would say see it on a real big screen if you can.
Yeah, thumbs up. I saw it first in a regular theater and then again in a Dolby Atmos theater, and it was very loud. The helicopters at the end all around you. It really envelops you. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. And go back. We actually have an episode on devs. I'll include a link to it in the email, but go check that out, too. All right, see you guys on Friday.